evening. We're delighted to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room today. And we have some special guests. We have Mid-State Technical College students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have high school students from Toma High School. Would you please stand? You may be seated, too. Students are here with an award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students to come and listen to an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, they're given materials about the case. And then after the second case, and this is the second case this morning, a justice assigned for the day will meet with the students and discuss the procedures of the court, taking cases, deciding cases, mandating opinions. The discussion is procedural. It is not on the substantive issues of either one of the two cases that we are going to hear this morning. So we welcome you all. Does anyone need a summary of the case that we're about to hear, facts and law? If so, please raise your hand. All right. No one has accepted that offer, so we will proceed with introducing the court. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second and last case for today and the month of November, according to our schedule. And it's 2012 AP818D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus James E. Hamas. And we will hear first from Mr. Hamas. Who's representing himself. He has 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal. And then we'll hear from Robert G. Crone, who represents the Office of Lawyer Regulation. You will have 30 minutes, Mr. Crone. Attorney Hamas, you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before the court, other than in a matter of 4 years ago, and I was represented by Lester Pines. This is my first oral argument before the court, and I appreciate the honor and the privilege. I believe it is important when a lawyer is subject to disciplinary proceedings that he be provided an opportunity to present oral argument, both for himself as well as standards that he may see should be established or set as part of the proceedings applicable to an attorney. These matters are divided into two matters. One is referred to commonly in the briefing as the Ohio matter, the other as the Bowers matter. As noted to the justices, I've stipulated to counts one and two, which are the conviction of a misdemeanor over nearly 10 years ago in the state of Ohio, and also as the failure of myself to report that. The only element that I would provide to the court as part of its assessment is that I was not an actively practicing attorney at that time in any capacity and hadn't been for 8 years, and I was completely unfamiliar that I had a responsibility to report the matter from Ohio to the state of Wisconsin Office of Lawyer Regulation. However, I did stipulate that that was an error, and I did stipulate that I was convicted of the misdemeanor. The other element to the Ohio matters are twofold, one in which pertains very specifically, and there's a lot of minutiae contained in the briefing. But it contends in count three that I did not pay all of the court costs. As identified in the documents of the actual exhibits to the case of the Ohio case, all the court costs on the only exhibit applicable to the individual matter to myself indicate court costs owed of zero. That's the only evidence that they have in written format connected to that. However, later on in the matter, years passed, It was brought to my attention when the Office of Lawyer Regulation brought this matter to my attention that there may be some type of straggler amount of 200 some dollars that was still due and owing. That matter was paid through a collection agency done through an EFT format, and I did not think anything of substantive would come out of the non-traceability of that amount. However, I emphasized in the briefing, as well as to the referee, that the terms of my sentence for that misdemeanor conviction was 1 year of probation. And as everyone here, I am sure, is familiar with, no one would have freed me from probation or allowed me to complete probation if I had not taken care of all the court costs and fines associated with the case. Certainly, as I wasn't subsequently incarcerated and I completed all the terms of probation, I feel that the probative weight of all the evidence on count three is one which I clearly paid the cost. There's no contradictory evidence. The only actual exhibit shows zero. And the information of a reasonable inference would be that since I completed my probation term, I completed all the obligations of the court.
In Wisconsin, another option would be to enter a judgment against you for the amount of unpaid restitution or court costs or things like that. Was a judgment entered against you?
No, it was not.
Okay,
I was only
you.
Merely contacted subsequently years later by a collection agency. No judgment has ever been entered against me relative to the Ohio matter. The other element to the Ohio matter, and I'm not me seeking to jump forward in terms of the evidentiary matters that took place on this, is an individual part as well as a more global application to attorneys I feel that are confronted with an Office of Lawyer Office of Lawyer Regulation investigation. And that very specifically is, I believe, the damaging and prejudicial methodology that is utilized by the Office of Lawyer Regulation and completely ignored by the referee on the inclusion of extremely inflammatory and prejudicial evidence that you are not charged with. I'm not expecting anyone to remember. I'm the one that lived it. But the similar situation happened to me 5 years ago with the State Public Defender's Office, wherein I was never accused of anything wrong by the State Public Defender's Office, but I spent over half of the matters involving my disciplinary action before this court were questions addressed about my relationship with the State Public Defender's Office, even though not one count ever came into place regarding that overall matter. In this situation, included in the complaint was a very specific and not even disguised effort to make sure that the referee, and including this court, was aware that a company, which I did not own, which was defunct, which had been taken over by a bank, had been convicted of 5 felony convictions for the hazardous waste situation that took place with that company. It's complained in the very beginning. It's asserted through the entire course of the proceedings. And what's most disturbing about its impact is the fact that the referee, in making his decision that on count three I had failed to pay all of my court costs, he actually references that case specifically. Even though it's not supposed to be included in evidence, even though I never was charged with anything connected to it, even though I wasn't even alleged to be in violation of any responsibilities I have under SCR, it was utilized through the entire course of the proceedings and the complaint. And most dramatically, the actual referee, in saying that I had failed to pay the required court cost, referenced specifically that case as being why I was found in violation of not paying the 200-some dollars. So it's just demonstrative that during the course of the proceedings, I think the referee was somewhat surprised when he commented during the proceeding, "You're objecting to this?" And I said, "Well, isn't this a proceeding that would follow the rules of evidence?" And he even commented, "You're right, we have to follow the rules of evidence." It was a surprising statement to be made by a referee. I objected to it, and he indicated that he would allow it to proceed accordingly. And in proceeding accordingly, he certainly ended up prejudicing not only my case specific to count three, but I also believe, and your justices are certainly capable of reading the decision, the almost sheer, as I put down here in terms of how I viewed the assessment, either predetermined bias against my truthfulness and my believability, or a complete non-objectivity because of various factors, and I believe inclusive of this, is a factor that the very first paragraph or two of a complaint is that a company that I was connected to it was found guilty of three felony counts of handling hazardous waste.
What was your connection with the company, counsel?
During the time frame of the incident, I had no ownership control of the company. During its existence, for I think a period of 3 years, I owned the company that owned that company. The company was based here in Wisconsin, and then we had a branch in Ohio.
All right.
And I never disguised that from anyone.
Were you an officer of that company?
I was an officer of the company at the time of its existence, not at the time of the matters associated with this trailer. The company had been defunct by then and had been closed down by the bank, Your Honor.
Well, then it had to have allegedly done these activities when it was not defunct.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not hear you.
It had to have engaged in these hazardous activities when it was not defunct. Isn't that right?
Correct.
And at that time, you would have been associated with it.
I don't seek to be overly specific, but at the time of its existence, the materials existed inside of a tank trailer inside of its premise. And after its defunctness, the tank trailer, while existing there, ended up needing to be disposed of its material, which was done, and then subsequently it was determined that that storage was not in compliance with Ohio law.
What do you want this court to be doing for you in this proceeding?
To examine counts 4 and then 5 through 9, I believe that the referee was clearly erroneous in counts 4 through 9, as well as I will identify, I believe that the guidelines utilized by the referee in terms of the level of discipline far exceeded any established guidelines, and the guidelines that were utilized or referenced by the Office of Lawyer Regulation extend activity that are multitudes in greater violation than even assuming that I was in violation of all of the counts connected to the level of discipline being imposed. As I identified in my brief, Your Honor, I believe that the case law established, even assuming that I was in violation of all of the counts, no greater than a public reprimand.
I thought you were also asking for a relief from count 3, not just 4 for 9.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I am seeking relief from count 3. I'm seeking relief from counts 4 through 9. That's the counts 4 through 9 are the Bauer matter.
Okay.
I was just going to segregate between the Ohio and the Bauer matter.
How many charges were made against you?
9, Your Honor. I admitted to 2, counts 1 and 2.
This is the second time you're here before this court, aren't you?
That is correct. I was here in 2010. Mm-hmm. All these matters predate me being here prior to you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us about counts 4 through 9?
Thank you, Your Honor. My position on counts 4 through 9 is also both individual and global. On the global element to it, I believe that it is an intentional action by the Office of Lawyer Regulation to create duplicity so that the count number increases significantly. If you examine on counts 3 and 4, they basically replicate the allegations that I did not timely respond to correspondence from a client, specifically a letter. If I could shift over to the count 4. I'm sorry. I'd like to retract Judge Prosser. Count 4 is specific to the determination that I was in violation of the depository amount of $1,395 into a trust account. As identified in the contract for legal services, that contract for legal services specifically conforms almost verbatim to the requirements under SCR 201.15B4M. Specifically that I had an advance fee paid. That advance fee identifies the number of legal hours required and contains the provisions relative to returns of the funds, resolution format of 30 days to the arbitration format, and conforms with the requirements of the contract for legal services. The referee made the decision that because I did not put it into my trust account, which is not required in this format, as well as I believe that the contract for legal services completely conforms with the requirements under SCR 20.15B4M, that I am not in violation of count 4. In addition, as I will address further on in the proceedings, Judge Prosser, I also believe I'm not in violation of count 4 due to the circumstances and on the limited period of time that the Bowers matter actually existed. Bowers is dealing with a 90-day time frame, literally between the time a contract and legal services was provided, payment was made, and the matter was filed with the Office of Lawyer Regulation. 90 days. Between that time frame, as I addressed in the brief, the file is open, monies are eventually received, materials are received from the defendant, correspondence goes back and forth with the defendant, a decision is made because, not because of any actions that I failed to do, but as identified, they didn't have any more money to be able to complete the contract for legal services. They sought in which to end the contract for legal services and proceed back with the returns of sums. Within 20-some days from receiving that, a complaint is filed with the Office of Lawyer Regulation. That's how swiftly everything moved in terms of this process. And so when the referee made the decision that I didn't conform with the requirements of my contract for legal services, I don't even think that the time frames contained in that allowed for one billing cycle to come through.
But, Counsel, I think
yes, Your Honor.
Wasn't the complaint that a refund was requested and you refused to give a refund? So, for whatever reason, there was a change of heart on behalf of the client's position and you didn't give the refund. I mean, isn't that why it moved so quickly?
I don't believe that that's the nature of the complaint made forth relative to the count four, Your Honor, in terms of my understanding of it. There was a request for a returns of the sums in August of 2010. During that sum, as I believe most are familiar with, we are dealing with an incarcerated individual who is communicating almost repetitively through his mother with our office. So I received the letter sometime in the middle of August. So under the terms of my contract for legal services, I now have 30 days to complete invoicing and to examine the work that was being completed. Within that 30 days, as you've seen from in the minutiae of the report, Mrs. Bowers dies. I'm then contacted to return monies to a funeral home because they can't pay for the burial of Mrs. Bowers, and looking over the material that I had completed, even prior to the 30-day cycle, I remitted a portion of that because I knew it did not exceed the amount of work seen on the timesheet. And then from that point forward, after that, I'm not disguising it, oddity existed. I will be the first to admit that it was a very odd situation that I confronted myself with. And maybe I should have, in retrospect, just taken a complete step back and looked at it differently. But from that point forward, then, by the beginning of September of 2010, the matter was before the Office of Lawyer Regulation. You're right, Your Honor. I had a probably 1 or 2 week gap that if I would have gotten that paperwork done, then I would have had everything submitted identifying I did work on the file. Here is what is either owed or not owed to me. And by the way, as you're aware, I paid a certain sum back to a funeral home per the request of you to complete the work. So as to count four, I believe that the decision of the referee was clearly erroneous. Specifically, as you identify, he can see that he was very confused or did not understand the requirements existing between the differentiation on advance funds and a trust account. Advance fund are a very standard format for a sole practitioner in particular or a small practitioner. They work within that structure, and that was the decision and change that was made to SCR accordingly. As to count five and six, Judge Prosser, in terms of the direction that you sought from it, this is one of the issues where I feel that the duplicity that exists within the Office of Lawyer Regulation on count increase comes into place before this court and is damaging and harmful to an individual who is attempting to address any contended violations to the court. In this instance, counts five and six direct themselves to, did I reasonably respond back and communicate with the clients to a July 14th letter? And then they said August 6th letter. So instead of examining what my degree of violation was on communicating with the client, I now am dealing with two counts. And the part that I addressed in terms of the briefing is one that I stand here on an individual basis as a small practitioner at the time. I no longer practice law, but as a small practitioner at the time, and as well as familiarity with dozens of public defenders that I've gotten to know over the years and other practitioners, is that the referee is establishing a guideline that if you are not responding back with an individual on a matter that neither had a deadline, neither had a request for a deadline from the party, they didn't say, get back to me as soon as possible, those types of formats, we are establishing under that SCR rule that a individual dealing with a criminal matter doesn't respond to a letter within 3 weeks. The one letter was 3 weeks. That is an establishment that we are failing to adequately communicate with the client. And I believe that format is extremely aggressive to exist. And while I'm just, I am not even questioning anything regarding the accuracy of the statement, I couldn't imagine that an audit of a half a dozen public defenders wouldn't see this inability, not intentionally, but this inability in which to correspond and communicate into that format. So in that capacity, on counts five and six, I would identify that as being one where, in particular, since if you look at the requirements that are contained within the communication SCR 20.1.4, there are actual very clear indications that it's extremely important to urgently communicate. I wouldn't say to use the word urgently, but as an example, when there's a deadline or there's been a decision. And certainly that's something that's really important for us to be aware of and to communicate back to our clients. But if you look at the context of the July 14th letter, it's, did you receive the PSI report? Did you get the my transcript? How are you coming along in terms of my legal assessment on a post-conviction brief? Now, one of the things as a practicing attorney that on a practical basis exists when you're dealing with a defendant that is incarcerated and has limited funds is that the worst thing that you can do for them is to expeditiously drain their resources before you establish a game plan on what's going to be most effective for them. Because if we, to be blunt, spin a lot in terms of the beginning part of it, then very little is going to be left relative to the briefing responsibilities to the defendant. So as
I understand yes, Your Honor. What that last sentence meant.
Okay. When you receive in a defendant's case, a criminal defendant's case, there is oftentimes a lot of activity where they want to explain all the reasons why they should not be in the situation that they're at. And if you take that and you, with the limited amount of time that they have available to utilize it, and spend all of your time assessing that information and let's say, overly communicating with the person, but really taking that element through the process, you have very limited resources remaining on where you need to really be hitting the hammer with, which is the briefing process. And when you, as you can see from Mr. Bowers, who is I've met and is from my had a good process to them, you can even see from his earlier correspondence, he is outlining how he thinks his case should go. He writes a letter. These are the case decisions. This is what I think that we should be focusing on. And combining that with the PSI report and a pre-sentence investigation that was I mean, and a transcript from Judge Ebert in Dane County, you have to watch just how much you're going to throw into that so that you do all of that work and you turn and say, I'm sorry, I need $3,000 more because I haven't even started on your brief yet. And that's something, and in terms of a practitioner basis, is a reality that I don't believe either the referee, Mr. Boyle, either had familiarity with or didn't understand that context with. I'm flashing off on time, so moving to, do you have anything else, Judge Bradley? Moving to two counts, 7 and 8, I would address in terms of the discretion brought by the erroneous decision. Accounts 7 and 8 direct themselves to the amount of money that was paid to me and the work that was performed. I do not need to, I feel that is important to examine Mr. Bauer's testimony, not my testimony. Mr. Bowers sent me the 100-page plus PSI and transcript. He sent me a 5, 6, 7, 8, 10-page letter regarding all the case decisions that he wanted. In his deposition taken as part of these proceedings, he testified that he understood I would be working on that material, that I would be spending time on that material, that I would review the material, his decisions, as part of my process. And so, therefore, when the referee made a decision, for example, he used the word void of any evidence of work performed, Mr. Bowers admitted himself that that material that he sent and the letters that he sent, he expected that would be part of the responsibilities that I would take and the amount of money that would be expended as part of his, on his behalf. Count 9 directs itself, and this is also an individual and a global element to individuals dealing with the Office of Lawyer Regulation. It is contended.
Did you ever provide your timesheets to your client showing the hours you worked and the days you worked and what you did on those days?
Only through the Office of Lawyer Regulation, Judge.
Why didn't you provide them right away to your client?
By the time that the process reached itself, the matter was already before the Office of Lawyer Regulation. In September of 2010,
why didn't you provide them August 6th or 7th when your client contacted you and wanted to terminate the representation because he didn't think anything was going on?
Well, he didn't say that in his letter, Your Honor. He said that he didn't have any more money, so he wanted to terminate the representation. I did not do it, Your Honor. I don't have an explanation as to why he didn't move quicker between August 6th and the time that the Office of Lawyer Regulation file was brought to the attention.
I mean, it seems to me if you're going to focus on the Office of Lawyer Regulation are bad guys and they say things and they move too fast, you never focus on yourself. But we're really here about you. We're not really here about the Office of Lawyer Regulation. That would be a different kind of proceeding, and that's not one that's before the court today. What's before the court today are allegations that you didn't hold up your responsibilities as a lawyer practicing in Wisconsin. So my concern is, how do you get around the findings of fact of the referee? Are any of the findings clearly erroneous?
Yes, I believe all of them, Your Honor, other than the ones that I stipulated to.
Let me just look at what I was just reading before I asked you my question again. Okay, Mr. Hamas did not produce the handwritten notes regarding Mr. Hamas's representation of Mr. Ian Bowers contained in Exhibit 4. Is that true or not true?
And as part of what count, Your Honor?
Count 9. This is a finding of the referee.
I did not, as part of the turning over of my file.
Okay, so you did not?
I was not requested of them, and I did not turn them over.
Mr. Hamas did not produce handwritten notes regarding Ms. Lori Bowers' funeral expenses to OLR regarding the payment of $400 to Gunderson Funeral Home. Is that true?
I did not turn over those notes, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hamas made misleading statements to OLR regarding the remittance of $995 to Mr. Ian Bower. Is that true?
That is not true, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you know what is the genesis for, to me it sounds more like a conclusion, but that you made misleading statements. Do you know what they're talking about there?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is it?
The framework is that in one of the answers that John Sizer requested of me is he said, please turn over your entire file relative to Mr. Bowers.
Okay.
And in turning over that entire file, which was this thick, I did not turn over my timesheets nor my work product.
Why in the world did you not?
I in terms of my understanding as to what constitutes the entire file, I did not make the connection that they included timesheets or the work product.
Why? I mean, that shows what the work that you did as a lawyer was all about, right? I mean, isn't that why lawyers send out statements to clients and narrate what they did so the clients will know what they did?
Your Honor, I didn't make the connection in that capacity at that point in time.
You don't think that timesheets and a narration of what you do is an evidence of practice of law?
It's representative of the amount of work that you'd complete as well as your work product. Yes, Your Honor, I believe it's part of your practice of law. I did not understand Mr. Zeiser's inquiry to mean that he sought my timesheets and my work product. I turned over the entire file. I answered 4 pages of questions.
That's fine. I understand.
Sorry,
I just think if you don't focus on yourself, rather than always trying to put the blame on somebody else, you're destined to repeat your mistakes over and over and over. I think you got to look at what might you have done that could have solved the problems you were facing rather than exacerbated.
There's nothing as part of my individual existence that doesn't already churn that through 1,000 times, Your Honor. If you don't think that I regret the fact that I could have communicated a letter on July 21st indicating I don't have anything to report at this time, or on August 12th saying your mother's calling me, begging me not to turn over the file instead of relying upon her. I play those matters over in my mind over and over and over again. I'm not trying to in any capacity, nor I have ever made any capacity, I think that the Office of Lawyer Regulation is some form of Gestapo out to get me. What I'm expressing is that the standards that are being established are ones which are excessive and in extreme in terms of a standard practice of law, in particular dealing with something that of this nature in this fact base. That's all. I have played over 1 million times in my mind what I could have done differently to resolve the matters that are sitting before me, especially on a matter like Bowers. I mean, there's small pieces that could have been done. I'm sitting here in front of the file, copying 100 pages. I go, well, should I put the work product in? Should I put the timesheets? They're in a separate little file. I didn't think at that moment in time that I'd be sitting in front of you, Judge, having you question my belief of the importance of doing things because in a separate little file I have my work product notes of 3 pages and my timesheets. But I went through the process of copying 100 pages and sent to them and sent out 5 pages of answers on a letter. Of course, I replay those in my mind over and over again relative to that. So I didn't mean in any capacity to feel as though I'm throwing someone else under the bus. I'm bringing it up in terms of the standards that are being established.
Thank you.
The only other, and I realize that I'm at the stop position. As I mentioned, Judge Abramson, the position that I feel that the case law has clearly identified itself as is that, setting aside, I believe that there is erroneous determination made in counts 3 through 9, even assuming in arguendo that I've been found in violation of a criminal misdemeanor and that I did not report it, as well as the handling of the Bowers matter, which involved itself within a 90-day period, the determination that I should be suspended for 4 months is excessive and has no correlation to the dozens and dozens of cases that I identified in the briefing that I provided. And what I will likely do in terms of rebuttal, I will address the rebuttal position on the amount of discipline to be identified so that Mr. Crone has a sufficient time in which to address the court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Crone, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Chief Justice, members of the court, it's again an honor to appear in front of you. I'm here as retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. This is a 9-count disciplinary complaint that the referee determined was proven to the requisite standard as to each count. Those findings are not clearly erroneous. His decision is very detailed. I don't know that it's necessary to go through every factual point. I want to, however, respond to a couple points that were made by Mr. Hammes. As to the first 2 counts, he said he was not licensed as a lawyer. Well, he raised that argument in front of the referee, too. And in the referee's opinion, he said, and I quote, that there was no credible evidence that he was not licensed. So I'm not sure why that's even mentioned here. There were two cases involving his business operation, one against him personally and one against ST&E. We put both cases in the complaint as and they objected to that in pretrial motions to the referee. The reason we did that is to provide the referee with some background, some context of what this business is about, what he's about, and how these two operations were both charged, he personally and then the corporation in Ohio. We did this just to show that there was a pattern of conduct in not paying costs, a pattern of behavior, and it was just in terms of context. We did not do it for the purpose of piling on or ganging up or trying to get a separate series of counts against him based upon ST&E. We didn't even raise the ST&E issues in the disciplinary matter. The disciplinary matter as to counts 1 and 3 only relate to the case against Mr. Hammes personally. The referee felt that it was his discretion. He found that there was no harm in those allegations. However, he did make a mistake. When he found that the costs had not been paid in the referee's decision, he based that upon Exhibit Number 1. Exhibit Number 1 is the cost page out of the clerk's office dealing with the ST&E case. He should have mentioned Exhibit Number 5, which is the critical exhibit that we relied upon, and that shows the costs that were incurred in the lawsuit against Mr. Hammes, which is the subject matter for Count 3. And that summary of costs, if you will, bill of costs or whatever it's called down there in Ohio, shows that there's a balance of $300-some that was never paid. Now, in addition, Mr. Hammes presented evidence or testified and presented a scrap of paper, and he testified about some bill collector approaching him and that he took care of it. Well, he didn't present any records of payment, no receipts, no invoices. The clerk's office shows that it wasn't paid, and the referee concluded that there was not sufficient evidence that it was paid, and there was evidence that it was not paid. And he made a finding that it was not paid. Based on that finding, count 3, I believe, is an appropriate finding and is not clearly erroneous.
Did he successfully complete his probation, and was a judgment entered against him?
Did he successfully complete probation? I don't know that.
Was he released from probation, or was it extended?
You know, I don't know that, as a matter of fact. All I know is that the court records show that the costs were not paid. The initial conviction that I have, probation was a part of it.
You believe? I couldn't hear you. Probation was what?
Probation was a part of it. I think Mr. Hammes could better address that.
Do you have any reason to disbelieve what Mr. Hammes said regarding he successfully completed probation and they discharged him and that no judgment was entered against him for any undue or unpaid costs?
I have no evidence on that subject, no reason to disbelieve him on that. I can say, however, that the court records don't show that it was paid. And the referee concluded that based on the evidence he heard, he didn't believe it was satisfying. As to counts, the Bauer case, counts 4 through 9, count 4, I think Mr. Hammes is confused. Count 4, we're not claiming that his law contract or his retainer agreement was insufficient or inappropriate. There was nothing wrong with his contract for legal services with Mr. Bauer. The problem is under the applicable rule, 20:1.15B, 4MB, 1.3, establishes a duty upon termination of the representation. And it's upon termination of the representation that a final accounting has got to be made of fees. And the referee found that that was not done here. And in addition, he found that the money was not deposited in the trust account, but under the retainer agreement, we're not saying it should have been or not necessarily had to be put in the trust account. We're saying that the duty arose after the representation, and the court or the referee concluded, although mentioning the fact that it wasn't put in trust, he did also mention that the duties referred to the provision dealing with the duties upon termination that were not satisfied. As to count 5 and 6, these deal with two separate communications from Mr. Bowers and Mr. Hammes' failure to respond to either one of them. And they involve, count five deals with keeping the client informed, and count six deals with keep responding to a request for information from the client. Now, I'll be the first to admit there's a very fine line between those two provisions and under any scenario. And the court has the authority, of course, to determine sanction and consider whether there's anything duplicitous about this. But I thought both letters established a separate responsibility on Mr. Hammes's part. They're separate counts or separate duties and, I think, separate violations. But if the court for some reason thinks that those should be bundled together, obviously we're not going to raise any stink about that, and that may be appropriate. I don't think it's going to affect at all the sanction issue when it comes to this case. And Mr. Hammes at one point suggested that he did respond to at least the first letter, and the referee, again, based on credibility determinations, found that he had not and found that counts five and six had both been violated. And I don't believe those findings of fact are clearly erroneous. Now, as to count seven, again, this is dealing with 20:1.5A, when Mr. Bowers had terminated the representation when he sent the separate letter. He didn't say in these many words, "You're fired," or "I'm terminating the representation." He said, "I paid you. You're not doing your work. Send me my money back. Thank you very much for what you've done. Sorry for the inconvenience this may cause you and wish you well in your practice of law." And we take that to, and then he invited him to deduct the cost of postage and everything else, but to provide an accounting. And that ended the relationship. And at that point in time, again, there was a duty on the part of Mr. Hammes to provide some kind of accounting of what he had done, did not do so. And the referee found as a conclusion of law, he referred to it under conclusion of law 5, but he said the record was void as to Mr. Hammes providing any legal services.
Counsel, I note that Mr. Hammes asserts that maybe OLR is piling on. There seems to be an acknowledgement that at least a couple of these could be combined.
I'm not sure I join in the word piling on, but
yes, that's right. Well, I'll tell you, the piling on and the kinds of things we have alleged here, I note that there's another complaint that's been filed by OLR against Mr. Hammes. What, if any, import does that have at all to this case?
A complaint that's pending?
I think so.
I don't know. I have no knowledge about that. That was never brought to my attention. I know nothing about it.
Now, this complaint, as I understand it, relates to events that were happening at about the same time that his prior OLR complaints were being prosecuted. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Last time he was before the court?
Mm-hmm. The last time that we had an OLR charge against him. It seems to me that it's roughly the same time period. Am I right?
I think if I recall correctly, I thought that question might be raised here. The prior conduct leading to the prior decision occurred in the 2007-2008 timeframe. That case was decided, I believe, in 2011. The conduct in this case occurred in 2010,
so I'm quite sure
mm-hmm. that the conduct at issue in this disciplinary case predated the decision of this court in the prior case.
But it's after the grievances that were set forth in the 2011 case that we have here.
I think so.
Because
yes.
What I was driving at is we had a case in which there was an overlap between case number one and case number two in the sense that the conduct complained of was during the same time period. And then the question arose whether, had they been prosecuted at the same time, would that have increased the sanction of the first case, or would the sanction have been the same? But you're telling me the fact situation is different here.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, some of the facts, I think, were, in the other case, there was I'm not recalling all of that with some enough detail, but I think there was some similarity to the events, the counts.
The offenses were similar.
Right.
Or the alleged offenses were similar.
Yes.
Even if it didn't involve the same people.
And, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. So getting back to count number seven, the referee concluded in his comments as to conclusion of law five that the record was void as to his providing any legal services, and Mr. Bauer had testified that to his knowledge there was no work done. Now, granted, during this investigation at the 11th hour, Mr. Hammes produced some time records and some notes that could be construed as work product, but he acknowledged he didn't turn that over to the client, didn't turn it over to the investigator when the investigation was underway. And I think the referee was appropriate in concluding that this, under the circumstances, was an unreasonable fee because there's no showing that he did anything to accomplish the purpose for which he was hired. And then under count eight, at the termination, there is a requirement of surrendering papers and refunding the fees not earned. That, again, is the same thing as in another count. And there was a demand for some sentencing transcripts and other things that he just did not respond to the client and, of course, never provided the client with any delineated detail of what was done and, of course, no refund. Count number nine is the last count dealing with appropriate cooperation with the OLR during an investigation, and the referee ticked off a number of respects that he believed that was not properly abided by. One was dealing with some misleading statement or letter to the OLR to the effect that he had accounted for the $995 paid by the client, and that was not correct and could not be documented. That perhaps the sentencing transcript had been returned when, in fact, that was not the case. And then there were some questions that the referee felt just were not adequately answered. So there was sufficient evidence to support that finding as well. As to sanction...
Can I ask you one thing about precedent, to the extent there's precedent on point? What cases... And what were the outcomes of those cases? Which cases are ones where the timing of the client's request and OLR involvement, what are closest to this case? And from Mr. Hammes' standpoint, this is a matter of a half a month, maybe a month, between contact from the client and OLR then being involved. What other cases where we have reprimanded or more a lawyer involve that kind of a time period?
Well, I don't know that either of us put together in our briefs any cases that dealt specifically with a question of a shortened timeline. I don't necessarily join in his description of this as a shortened timeline that hampered his ability to respond. I don't necessarily agree with him. The timeline... This can be found in the documents and the letters from the client and so forth that were ignored. But no, I cannot cite to you a specific case where the timeline foreclosed compliance with an OLR regulation.
You have to go in front of the microphone.
Yeah, a little closer.
Otherwise, they don't.
We
sure.
want to preserve this for history.
So,
I'm glad you consider it historical, Justice.
So as far as when did OLR get the case? When was the complaint filed with OLR?
I'm going to have to dig for that.
All right, that's all right. When was the client letter that you think was the one he should have responded to, and when should he have responded to it by?
Again, you'll have to go back to the microphone, counsel. According to...
The client letters that were not responded to were in... July 14th, 2010, which is Exhibit 17, and August 6th, 2010, which is Exhibit 15.
Okay. And he should have responded to those by what date?
And I think, well, he should have responded to those within a reasonable time to the client. I would think, I don't know that there's any rule on this, but I would think
I'm just trying to figure out from
days,
other...
20 days at, or so to respond.
Okay.
This was 23, if my count is right.
I'm sorry?
This was 23 days.
These are two separate letters, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, according to the respondent's brief, the complaint was filed with on April 16, 2012.
April 18th, 2012, I have the complaint filed.
Okay. The referee's decision was July 31, 2013.
The referee's decision not sure it's dated. I'd have to dig through my records as to when I received it.
Well, Mr. Hammer says it's in July 31, 2013. Close enough.
Disciplinary hearing was held on May 14, 2013. Briefing was completed in early June 2013.
He signed it on July 30. It's dated July 31, 2013.
July 31, 2013. There is a date below a signature. I'm sorry, yes.
In this case, with respect to the latter counts, as I understand it, you had an individual who had been convicted of a motor vehicle offense in which two people were killed and another person was injured, and that he was sentenced to incarceration for 6 years.
Yes.
Now, that was in 2008 that the conviction occurred.
2005? Oh, I'm sorry, yes, 2008.
And the
2007, excuse me, September 2007.
Conviction?
He was sentenced on January 11, 2008.
All right, okay. Sentenced in 2008. Now, Mr. Hammes was approached in May of 2010.
Yes.
And the goal was apparently not to overturn the conviction, but to try to get a sentence modification, that is something other than 6 years in the prison.
That was right? The goal. That was the goal, I guess.
Yes. Now, I don't know how busy Mr. Hammes was, but was it unreasonable to say that this is not as urgent as certain other matters? I mean, we start out near the end of May, and he's terminated. They are asked for his money back in early August. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. It is a short timeline, but the timeline was dictated by the client. Mr. Bowers had a realization that he couldn't, he was not getting answers from his attorney. He couldn't afford the retainer, and he said, let's stop this.
And didn't Mr. Hammes earn anything?
I'm sorry?
Mr. Hammes didn't earn anything during the time that he was engaged?
Well, the referee felt that there was not sufficient evidence of any meaningful legal work done. He didn't provide any. When the case was being investigated, he didn't provide any to the client. And then at the time of the disciplinary hearing, he did put in some records, albeit very sketchy. And it's based on that that the referee concluded that a refund was required. you're asking me, did he do any work? I can't. I'm sure that he consulted with his client, and he was sent a sentencing report and so forth. I would assume that he read that, but this was never documented by him. He never came forward to provide that kind of information.
Well, when he supplied to OLR the information in a particular file that didn't include his timesheets or his records of work, did the OLR come back and say, do you have timesheets?
I don't know if it was put in those words at that time. I know that as the investigation went on, I'm thinking that there were some additional follow-ups on that, but he didn't provide the work product that would have been a part of a file and didn't provide any timesheets. So should it have been specifically asked for? Well, in hindsight, retrospect, perhaps that might have been a better practice. But that's what was done, and nothing was really forthcoming.
But, Counselor, throughout the findings of the referee and the conclusions, he finds Mr. Hamas not a credible witness.
Yes.
His explanation, this is a quote, his explanation regarding the production of his file material, not including timesheets and work products, is not credible. So I'm not sure where we can go from here. We'd have to disbelieve the findings of the referee. Were you counsel of record before the
yes.
hearing before the referee?
Yes. And the evidence was, as I said it was, he didn't have the OLR investigator, Mr. Weber, testify, did not have any information in response to the request for the file that showed any meaningful work done. And Mr. Hamas put in some notes at the time of the hearing, and the referee made his decision.
Thank you.
Mr. Krohn, I want you to take the gloves off here and tell us exactly why this attorney should be suspended for 4 months. This is not exactly the case of the century. And I mean, take the gloves off. Tell us why there's suspension for 4 months.
I can't remember being invited to ever take my gloves off. But
keep your shoes on, though, if
I'll
you
keep
would.
Keep my shoes on and take my gloves off. Well, a number of reasons, Your Honor. Number one is this is not the first time Mr. Hamas has been in front of the disciplinary system and had to answer for some very similar violations. Now, do they match up chronology-wise to show a pattern? I'm not sure that makes a difference. He has been repeatedly violating the same rules. That's one reason. And he has had the benefit of prior discipline, and I think that this particular discipline should be enhanced, if you will, to what he's had in the past. And furthermore, if you read, as Justice Rogensack mentioned, the referee's report, you can see that the referee is very disturbed with Mr. Hamas. He's very disturbed. He's making a number of credibility findings contrary to Mr. Hamas. A number of them. And then, contrary to I guess my gloves weren't off at the time of recommending the sanction, at least in the minds of the referee, because we recommended a lower sanction than was imposed by the referee. And so there you have the referee.
Recommended what?
We recommended
90 days
or 3 months suspension, and the referee went with 120 days, I believe. And so there you have it. The referee has got Mr. Hamas in front of him. He's heard all the witnesses, Robert Weber from OLR. Mr. Bauer, by deposition, testified out of prison. Very frustrated with the fact that he hired a lawyer, didn't get any work product out of him, didn't get anything back from him. And then Mr. Hamas is making up stories about paying a funeral bill out of some of the money, that he had some authorization for that. That was refuted at the hearing. So every time Mr. Hamas took a position, there was evidence contrary to what, essentially evidence contrary to what he was offering, and which was directly raised credibility issues. which the referee time and again found in favor of Ovalar. So that's it. I think it's certainly a case for a suspension. Am I going to say now that the referee's suspension recommendation it makes more sense than ours did at the time? No, I think that's your decision. But I do think it's a case for a short-term suspension. I'm getting the feeling you didn't think I took maybe all the gloves off her. But that's the position. I mean, it's a credibility case, a number of violations, prior misconduct, and a very vulnerable client, I might add. Mr. Bowers in prison, waiting for some activity on his behalf. And nothing is forthcoming.
So you could defend 90 days as well as 120 days.
I'm sorry?
I said you would defend 90 days as a suspension period as well as 120.
I would defend either one of them. I think an argument could be made under the cases, and the cases, there's no one case on all fours with any of these disciplinary cases, one that went to the other. But I think on balance it's a short-term suspension, and I have no problem with the 90 days and certainly none with the 120 days.
What about 60?
Pardon me?
What about 60 days? I'm trying to get sense.
No, I don't think 60 days is a sufficient sanction, given for all the reasons I've already announced. So I don't have a red light, but I've run out of things to say. I can answer more questions.
The $400... funeral costs, you said that was refuted before the referee? Explain that.
Well, Mr. Hammes paid over some money out of his account, business account, for the funeral of his client's mother. And his contention was that the client had authorized that and that the client's grandmother had authorized that. This is Grolke. Well, the client refuted that. And moreover, Ms. Grolke testified from out of state by telephone at the disciplinary hearing. She said, I never authorized that. So the referee felt that, I believe the referee felt that that was not a credible position that he was taking. However, Mr. Bowers, I believe, offered the fact that, well, had he been asked, he probably would have said that's fine to pay that funeral expense. And as a result of that, the referee said, well, that amount of loss to the client should not be a part of the restitution award. And so the referee recommended that funeral expense not be a part of any restitution order. And OLR has no objection to that. Okay?
The funeral expense was paid, though.
The funeral that
you
money,
said it was refuted. Are you saying Mr. Hammes lied and he never paid that?
No. It was paid. The question was it authorized to be paid out of his business account, out of the funds that were the client funds?
Do you have any reason to believe he had some interest in the funeral home being paid, or that I don't really get how a lawyer would know to pay a funeral home without someone suggesting that be done?
That might be a question for Mr. Hammes. I have no idea why he would have done that, but the people that he claims gave him authorization to do it both refuted it. But the referee said it's harmless, and I don't think it should be a part of restitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Hammes?
Specific, I believe that the issue regarding the $400 before I move into the disciplinary format is important. As you can see, the referee had a very negative opinion of myself, and that's a clear example of credibility where it all triggered in an opposite direction from the obvious and the logical. So I would have logically been able to superimpose where to send $400 to a funeral home, or who I should contact as the pastor, who I should talk to at the funeral home, because no one told me to do it and I just did it all myself. It makes no logical sense in any capacity whatsoever. that I didn't receive a phone call from Mrs. Grulke, and that in truthfulness, she is the one that's being dishonest. I received a phone call from Mrs. Grulke. She said, we need money. We can't bury Ms. Bowers. You owe money to Mr. Bowers. You need to contact this pastor, and you need to contact this funeral home, and please send what you can. If not, we can't bury her. How would I have gotten any of that information without that type of instruction? But instead, the referee, which in my opinion, and I'm not taking this judge to say deflecting any responsibility I have for myself, is indicative of his excessive biasness and non-objectivity to anything that I said that went through the entire course of the proceedings. And this is actually the clearest example where he was so egregiously erroneous that how anyone would come up with that string of connection to end up sending a $400 check to Patrick at Gunderson Funeral Home to benefit Mrs. Bauer without having some form, but instead, I'm the one that's lying, not everyone else, after we're sitting in front of a referee. As to discipline, I would like to point out something very important to the court. The Ohio matter, were in 2005. When I said I never said I wasn't a licensed attorney in the state of Wisconsin. I said I wasn't actively practicing. So I didn't know, and I'd be honest, I had no idea that you were required to report a misdemeanor from another state as part of your responsibilities to as a lawyer. I know now, but in 2005, I didn't know that. It was investigated through another collateral matter that the Office of Lawyer Regulation did, and before you, I admitted to both. And as Judge Ziegler identified, Mr. Krohn respectfully admitted to, how would I have gotten released from probation and not a judgment and put into jail if I hadn't paid all the known court costs connected to the proceeding? But you're right, credibility is a significant issue here, and I agree. I believe that the manner in which the referee saw how my conduct, and as triggered from that, came into place, I would point out, was very damaging to me. And I think it prejudiced all the way from ST&E's inclusion to the fact that obviously there wasn't a sense in the world that you couldn't have figured out that Mr. Weber, the investigating officer for the lawyer regulation, and myself did not have a very strong connection. Mr. Weber testified, and this is the point that I'm not sure if Judge Prosser or Judge Bradley brought to the attention, is that he was asked those questions in cross-examination. What prevented you, when you saw the file, to write one more letter, one paragraph saying, I'm not seeing work product or your timesheets, because I consider that to be your entire file? And Mr. Weber's response was, well, I didn't think it was necessary, and he could have done it when he did the report. So he knew he could have done it. I'm not putting the responsibility on him, but one simple question saying, I got your file, I disagree with what constitutes an entire file, and I need your worksheets. I'm not trying to say this in terms of the matter that Judge Aberson brought, but if you actually knew the specifics of that, in all those cases, I was asked for the worksheets as well. So very specific questions put forth in that in all of those matters that are now another supplemental matter before the court. As to discipline, the material that is identified in here, I address on page 14 of my brief, and just trying to demonstrate the extreme degree that the discipline is being sought, and I believe punitively being sought, is if you look at just even one of the disciplinary proceedings referenced in the Office of Lawyer Regulations recommendation. For example, Danielson, he did not perform work for a client for 22 months. And he was suspended for 60 days. 22 months. He didn't even tell in other matters, for example, the discipline of Fike's letter, where he also had a 60-day suspension. He had an open probate case for 5 years. And had five order to show causes that he never told his client about. And I'm here within a short period of time frame, again, recognizing in retrospect, as the judge identified, I wish I could have done a half a paragraph letter and it would have been completely different. But the amount of identification in here of the degree, and no one even reaches 90 days. In addition, the cases that I reference repeatedly in my brief show people that are convicted of misdemeanors. There's one where there's an OWI felony and two misdemeanors at the same time, and he got a public reprimand, a felony count, and he's dealing with a public reprimand. And that's where, in the context of just this matter, now I agree that when Bowers was going on, and I know I'm completely out of time, but when Bowers was going on, I was months away from appearing for you for the first time, which I sat in that chair weeping half the time. I was so nervous and so ashamed of what I had done to the court, to the judge in Jefferson, and to the Board of Bar Examiners. But this is a different set of circumstances, and I'm seeking to identify that as this was moving forward, I did not yet clearly understand the impact the court would see regarding the one matter. And in that matter, in the prior matter, it involved an individual. I was retained, and in his opinion, I hadn't done anything on his file for 9 months.
Counsel.
So, and I'm not trying. Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. I realize I'm finished.
To sum up, it's my understanding that you concede as to counts 1 and 2, but that not to the other counts. You think they're not supported. And then, what do you think is the appropriate discipline in this case?
The case law identifies that a public reprimand is in order, even if it is a determination of this court that I was in violation of all 9 counts. I believe that I was only in violation of 2 counts, but even with that context, the case decision shows the misdemeanors, folks that, attorneys that have been convicted of a misdemeanor, have uniformly been provided a public reprimand to identify the seriousness that a misdemeanor carries in terms of your diligence and duty as an officer of the court.
And that's what your brief asks for.
Yes, Your Honor.
Page 41. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Thank you.
This concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 818D, OLR versus James E. Hammerson. This case is, and all of these OLR cases are difficult for the court, and court takes this under advisement. The court will meet in closed conference at 12:45. What time is it now?
12:45.
Okay. 12:45. Justice Crooks will be meeting with the students right after we conclude, and the court is adjourned for oral argument for the month of November, barring any unforeseen activity that requires oral argument. We are adjourned. Court will meet at